I could put a bullet through the bastard, Zuger growled. It's too late for that, Clinton told him, for the dhow had passed beneath their bows, and the gunboat was as close to the menacing fangs of coral as she dared go. Clinton called to his quartermaster at the gunboat's wheel, "Heave ho, and bring her head to wind." Then, spinning on his heel, "Away the boarding party!" There was a squeal of davits as the crowded whaler dropped out of sight towards the choppy green sea alongside, but already the dhow was pitching wildly in the lines of seething white surf that guarded the reef. It was 2 days since that dead-flat calm had broken, and since then the trades had worked up a goodly swell. It came sweeping in across the inshore channel in low green humps with dark wind-scarred backs. But as soon as they felt the tilt of the land, they peaked up eagerly, the crests turning opaque as green jelly, shivering and wobbling, and then collapsing on themselves and surging in tumultuous white water up onto the black fangs of the reef. The dhow caught one of the taller swells, threw up her stern, and went racing down upon it like a surf-boat, with the skinny old Arab at the tiller prancing like a trained monkey on the stick of the tiller to hold her in the wave. But the dhow was not built for this work, and she dug her shoulder rebelliously into the sliding, roaring chute of green water, breaching so fiercely to the wave that the water poured aboard her in a green wall, and she wallowed broadside, half swamped, before she took the reef with a force that snapped off her single mast at deck level and sent yard and sail and rigging crashing over the side. In an instant she was transformed into a broken hulk, and clearly the watchers on Black Joke's deck could hear the crackle and rending of her bottom timbers. "There they go," Clinton muttered angrily, as the dhow's crew began to abandon her, leaping over the side and using the swells to carry them over the reef into the quieter waters of the lagoon, thrashing and kicking until the beach shelved up beneath them. They saw the old Arab steersman amongst his survivors. He waded ashore, beard and robe plastered against his body with seawater, and then lifted his robes to his waist, exposing skinny legs and shrunken buttocks, as he scampered up the white beach with the agility of a goat and disappeared amongst the palm groves. Black Joke's whaler pulled swiftly into the first line of breakers, the ensign in the stern peering over his shoulder to judge the surf, and then catching his wave, taking her in with a rush, swinging sharply into the lee of the dhow's stranded hull, where there was calmer water. They watched the ensign and four of his men go up over the side, pistols and cutlasses drawn, but by this time the last of the Arab crew was staggering up the beach and into the sanctuary of the palm grove a quarter of a mile away across the lagoon. The ensign led his men below decks, and they waited on Black Joke's quarterdeck, watching the abandoned dhow through the telescope. A minute passed before the ensign appeared on deck again. He crossed quickly to the dhow's rail and leaned against it to vomit over the side, then straightened up and wiped his mouth on the back of his sleeve before shouting an order down to the oarsman in the whaler. Immediately the whaler shot out from the lee of the hull and pulled lustily back through the surf towards Black Joke. The boatswain came in through the entry port and knuckled his forehead to his captain.
Mr. Ferris's compliments, sir, but he needs a carpenter to get the slave decks open and two good men with bolt cutters for the chains.
He had gabbled this out in a single breath, and he paused to refill his lungs.
Mr. Ferris says as how it's fierce bad below decks, and some of them is trapped, and he needs the doctor.
I'm ready to go, Robin cut in.
Wait, Clinton snapped.
But Robin had gathered her skirts and run.
If my sister goes, I'm going too. Very well then, Ballantyne, I'm obliged for your assistance, Clinton nodded. Tell Ferris we have an incoming tide, full moon tonight, so it will make springs. There is a 22-foot tidal fall on this coast. He will have less than an hour in which to work.
Robin appeared on deck again, lugging her black leather valise, and she had exchanged skirts for breeches once more. The seamen on deck gawked at her legs curiously, but she ignored them and hurried to the ship's side. The boatswain gave her a hand, and she scrambled down into the whaler, with Zuger carrying her valise behind her. The ride in through the surf was terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. The whaler tilted forward at an alarming angle, the water hissing and creaming alongside, with a belly-swooping rush that ended alongside the dhow's heavily canted side. The deck was running with water, and listed so steeply that Robin had to crawl up it on her hands and knees, and each time a wave struck the hull, it quivered and shook, and more water came streaming down over the deck. The ensign and his boarding party had ripped the hatches off the main hold, and as she reached them, Robin gagged and choked with the solid stench that came out of that square opening. She had believed herself hardened to the smell of death and corruption, but never had she experienced anything like this. "Did you bring the bolt cutters?" the ensign demanded, white-faced with nausea and horror. The bolt cutters were heavy-duty shears used for cutting the shrouds and halyards from a dismasted vessel. Two men wielded them now as they lifted a bunch of small black bodies through the hatch, all of them fastened together at wrist and ankle by the clanking black steel links. It reminded Robin of the cut-out paper dolls she had amused herself with as a child, fashioning with scissors a single figure from the folded sheet and then pulling out a chain of identical dolls. The cutters crunched through the light chain, and the limp little bodies fell apart. "They are children," she cried out aloud, and the men around her worked in grim silence, dragging them out of the hatch, cutting them free, and dropping them on the tilted wet deck. Robin seized the first of them, a skeletal stick figure, crusted and streaked with dried filth, vomit, and feces, head lolling as she lifted it into her lap. No. There was no life. The eyeballs had dried already. She let the head drop, and a seaman dragged it away. No, and no, and no again. Some of them were already in an advanced state of putrefaction. At a word from the ensign, the seaman began dropping the wasted corpses over the side to make room for those still coming up from below. Robin found her first live one. There was a feeble pulse and fluttering breath, but it did not need a physician's instinct to tell that the hold on life was tenuous. She worked swiftly, apportioning her time to where the chance of life seemed greater. Another tall wave struck the dhow, and it tilted sharply. The timbers crackled and snapped deep inside her. "Tide's flooding. Work faster," shouted the ensign. They were into the hull now. Robin could hear the thud of sledgehammers and the rip of irons as they began to tear the slave decks out of her. Zuga was in there, stripped to the waist, leading the attack on the wooden barricades. He was an officer with the easy way of commanding, and his natural leadership was swiftly acknowledged by the seamen around him. The hubbub reminded Robin of a rookery at sundown, the shrieks of the returning birds and the answering cries from the chicks in the nests. The mass of black girls were aroused from the lethargy of approaching death by the dhow's wild antics, the crash of breaking timbers, and the flood of cold salt water into the hold. Some of those lying in the bilges were already drowning as the hold flooded, and some of them had realized that there was a rescue team aboard, and cried aloud with the last strength of waning hope. Alongside the slaver, the whaler was moored, and she was almost filled with the wasted bodies, in which some life still burned, while on the surface of the lagoon bobbed 100 or more corpses with gas-swollen bellies like the corks on a fishing net. "Take them to the ship," the ensign shouted down to his oarsmen in the whaler, "and come back for more." As he spoke, another white-crested wave struck the dhow solidly, and she heeled. But she was pinned down by the spikes of coral driven through her bottom timbers, otherwise she would have turned turtle. "Robin," Zuga shouted at her from the hatch, "we need you." For a moment she did not even glance at him, but shook her head at the sailor beside her. "No, she's gone." Expressionlessly the sailor picked up the frail body and dumped it over the side. Then Robin scrambled up to the hatch and dropped through it. It was a descent into the pit, dark after the brilliant noontide, so that she paused for a moment to let her vision adjust. The tilting deck beneath her was slippery with human waste, so that she had to cling for a handhold. The air was so thick that for a minute she nearly panicked, as though she were being smothered by a stinking, damp pillow. She almost fought her way back into the sweet sunlight. But then she forced herself to take a gulp of it, and though her guts heaved, and she tasted the bitter flooding in the back of her throat, she kept it down. Then her own discomfort was forgotten as she made out the chaos about her. "That last wave," Zuga grunted, as he steadied her with an arm about her shoulder, "the decks have collapsed." Like a house of cards, they had folded in upon each other. Raw splinters of timber thrusting up out of the gloom, balks crossed like the blades of scissors, with small dark bodies trapped in the jaws, others crushed by the fallen beams, squashed so that they were no longer recognizable as human, others dangling head down on their ankle chains, suspended in space, writhing weakly as crippled insects, or hanging quietly, swinging to the Tao's movements. "Oh, sweet mother of God! Where to begin?" Robin whispered. She let go her handhold, starting forward, and her feet shot out from under her on the slick-coated deck, and she went plunging down into the hold. She struck heavily, and pain flared in her back and lower body, but she dragged herself onto her knees. Her own pain seemed insignificant in this terrible prison. "Are you all right?" Zuga asked anxiously, but she shrugged his hands away. There was one girl screaming. Robin crawled to her. Her legs were crushed below the knees, trapped under a balk of hand-hewn timber. "Can you move that?" she asked Zuga. "No, she's done for. Come, there are others." "No!" Robin crawled back to where her bag had fallen. The pain was bad, but she forced it below the surface of her consciousness. She had only seen a leg amputation performed once before. When she started, the girl threw off the seaman who held her and attacked Robin like a tortured wildcat. Her nails raked skin from Robin's cheek, but by the time Robin had freed the first leg below the knee, the child was silent and limp. She died before Robin had reached the bone of the second leg, and Robin was weeping chokingly to herself as she left the body still hanging in the grip of the timber balk. She scrubbed her hands together. They were bloodied to the elbows, her palms sticky against each other. She felt consumed by guilt at her failure, without the strength to move. Dully she stared about her now. The hold was more than half flooded. The tide pounded remorselessly at the ship's hull. "We have to get out," Zuga called to her urgently. And when she did not turn her head, he seized her shoulder and shook her roughly. "There's nothing more we can do. It will capsize at any moment." Robin was staring down into the stinking black waters, which sloshed from one end of the hold to the other. A single hand broke through the surface directly below her. A child's hand, with soft pink palm and pretty tapered fingers, spread in a gesture of appeal. The iron cuff seemed too large for the narrow wrist, and it weighted it down, so the hand sank gently, disappearing from her sight. She stared after it with infinite regret. Then Zuga hauled her roughly to her feet. "Come on, damn it!" His face was savage, haunted with the horrors he had experienced in this fetid, half-flooded hull. The next wave hit the swamped hull, and this time it broke the grip of the coral. Timber squealed as it twisted and tore, and the dhow began to roll. The filthy waters rose up out of the darkness into a steep black wave and burst about them shoulder deep. The damaged slave decks broke free, sliding down over each other, tumultuous and lethal, releasing a fresh layer of tightly packed black bodies to tumble loosely into the flooded depths. "Robin, we'll be trapped!" He dragged her up towards the square of brilliant sunlight, clambering over timbers and bodies. "We can't leave them," Robin resisted. "They're finished, damn it! The whole thing is going. We have to get out." She pulled her arm free, stumbled, collapsed backwards, hit something so that pain flared through her lower body again, and she cried out with the strength of it. She was lying on her side, couched on a pile of linked bodies, and there was a face a foot from hers. It was alive. She had never seen such eyes, cat-fierce, falcon-bright, the colour of boiling honey.